You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to a, I guess, special episode of Why People Won't Save You.
I'm one of your hosts,
Jordan Clark.
And I'm the other one, Cameron Mason.
And we are very happy to be joined once again by Aisha Harris of NPR to help us figure out a movie that I feel like it's been the discussion ever since that trailer came out a few months ago, and the discussion has only gotten stickier as the movie is now in theaters. We are talking about the American Society of Magical Negroes, and two things before we even get into the movie, because this is one of the things that's frustrating me about this movie. Just to make it clear off top, before we even get into any of the discussion, like, one of the things that this movie is doing that is not helping anything is giving more ammunition to people like Candace Owens and a lot of the right-wing sect of people who are raging these culture wars and coming at this, like, this movie was on the radar because of the title, and like, anything you try to look up about it is all just people online like, see, I told you this movie was gonna suck because black people and like all this other bullshit. So like, anybody who's coming here for any kind of woke culture war, like, you can fuck off, like, fuck you, like, that's not, look at the title of our show and then think about maybe what the discussion is going to be.
I feel like the title of this movie and the title of our podcast are like opposing energy blasts, like a Dragon Ball Z fight. It's like, you know.
So I wanted to get that off up top. And two, like, we're doing this very specifically because, like, I think all three of us agree in terms of black culture, black criticism, discussing black film and black art, like, we should be honest about what we're seeing and what we're receiving and what's being shown to us, even if it's from our own people. I know a lot of people were still kind of like, gotta support black art, black people, but, you know, it's not even a kinfolk, skinfolk situation, but more so like, it's not our duty to make this shit work. Like, it's a two-way street. Like, you got to give us something to work with. It's just, you can't just be black and make some bullshit and then like get five stars. So
tell them we gotta work twice as hard.
I know we don't have a lot of time, but I just wanted to get that off top just in case anybody was dropping in having not been familiar with this show and how we operate. So
that's right, come in hot.
I got a three-part question for both of you guys to start. Right, I'm gonna start with you, Aisha. What was your initial reaction to the trailer of this movie when it first came out? What was your feeling going into the movie before you saw it, just in terms of like, were you like, you know, maybe trailer wasn't for me, but I'm still into it, or like, I'm apprehensive, but I want to give it a chance? And then once you finally saw the movie, what was going through your mind as you turned it off?
As a general rule, I tend to avoid trailers because I just want to go into movies as a critic. I want to go in with the least amount of expectation possible. Like, obviously, it's impossible in most scenarios to do that, even if you don't watch trailers, because you might know who the actors are, be familiar with the director's work. So, like, you're going to be coming at it with some sort of expectation. But then once this trailer started, Black Twitter started blowing it up, I was like, okay, I guess I have to watch this trailer. So I watch it and I was like, what is, okay. But in the back of my mind, I was like, there has to be a catch that we're just not getting. There's like some kind of twist. There's probably some Jordan Peele-esque thing that happens that like upends. And trailers can be really bad. They might show you the entire movie, but then they might not. And sometimes they are just completely a mismatch in tone. They don't match what the final product actually is. So I was like, I know, I get it, but I also don't want to judge this film based on a trailer alone. And like, it does feel like an interesting concept. Like, I'm not opposed to the idea of this concept, you know, in the abstract, we should say. So I saw it at Sundance. I was at the premiere at Sundance, and I went into it being like, yo, I'm going to be as open-minded as I possibly can. We'll see how this goes. I get out of that film, and it's funny because this was the premiere. So it was a packed house. It's in one of the largest theaters that's a part of that festival. Mm-hmm. Pretty mixed crowd. Like there were plenty of Black people there, but it's also like a lot of white people there too. I don't think I heard more than like a couple of light chuckles throughout the whole thing. And there's like one line that's not even said by a Black character in the film that got like the largest laugh. And it was about unions. Like it wasn't even about race. And so like I could tell, oh, this movie is not playing the way it's clearly supposed to. And not just for Black people, but also the white people in it too, because it was very quiet. So yeah, I got out of it and I ran into a fellow Black critic, Robert Daniels, fantastic. He writes for Roger Ebert. And we were both like, we spent like 10 minutes going off on this movie. We're like, what did we just watch? So yeah, I can't wait to talk more with you about it. I saw it again when I wrote the review on NPR, because I was just like, I need to like double check like my facts, because when you're at Sundance, it's just like you're seeing movies and movies, right, and movies, and you're bleary eyed and whatever. So I wanted to make sure I got like all the plot points, you know, accurate. But I was like, man, this movie is still not. It's worse the second time around, because you notice even more things and more like gaps of logic where it's just like, what are we doing here?
Cameron, same three questions. Reaction to the trailer, thoughts going into it before you'd seen anything, and then reaction post having seen the movie.
Okay, so I was raised around people whose third eye was just always exposed and out. So I already was on high alert when I saw this trailer. I was like, I mean, on top of it, I was kind of excited for the day where I, you know, went to my local movie theater. It was like, one for Magical Negroes, please, you know? I was ready. I was ready for the whole experience. And I will say the trailer, yeah, had me a little bugged out. I was waiting for that third act reveal, some kind of joke that's like, haha, we're all having a laugh here. Like, you know, we'll wink and a smile, something. And then so time comes. And actually, funny enough, you saw the movie first, Jordan. You saw the movie first that afternoon.
Yes.
And I remember texting you and saying, do I have to see this? And then I followed up. I think you went to like a 12:30 show or something like that. I ended up going to a 4:30. And 2 hours later, I was first, I'm just more bored than anything. This movie has the nerve, the audacity. Yes. As a comedy, to be unfunny for a very long period of time. Just, in general, unfunny.
Yeah.
Right? Kind of just straight up, the vibes ain't, it's not cooking, the vibes are off.
It's very oddly paced.
Yes.
Yeah.
I feel like there's things that are just like straight up bits that are like, we're supposed to be in on the joke here as the bit revs up to whatever punchline it's coming to. I feel like the audience is just like kind of lost, kind of like looking for it too. We're kind of like grasping for straws a little bit. And then here it comes. I'm waiting for that third act reveal, right? And then we get, you know, as we spoke earlier, like this unintelligible monologue over like the last 3 minutes of him like having the big revelation. And it's unintelligible because there's three other white characters that are talking over him, and it's mixed. Yeah. Crazy, because if you're sound mixing, I'm thinking you want to hear one conversation above all the other ones, or at least one monologue above the others, right? Just mix one down. I just, that left me confused. And then, you know, I walked out. I was just PO'd that I went to a movie theater and saw a boring comedy in 2024. more so than it like missing the racial commentary or anything like that. More so pissed off that I saw a bad comedy that wasn't even on, like, it's not even like low-key funny. It's not even,
yeah.
I don't know. It's disappointing mostly.
I will say my opinion, I will take directly from one David Alan Greer and just say off top,
hated it.
Hated it, right? So not since
there you go.
I was waiting.
Not since Queen and Slim have I been so confused by the politics of a film. Have I been so just completely thrown off between what was advertised and what I actually got, and had so many questions about the people who made the movie because in similar instances, Queen and Slim, we get to the end of the movie and I'm just looking at the other black people in the theater and we're like, that's okay, that's how that ends. Sure. All right.
That's how they gonna do us.
This movie, I saw this movie on a matinee because I wasn't trying to pay full price. I think there was 8 to 9 people, myself included, 2 white people, 2 just disparate black people, 2 black people who had come together. I sat at the very top because I was just trying to observe, and then I think maybe 1 or 2 people had come in. Before we get to the big payoff, 2 of the black people walk out of the theater. Another black person walks out and then comes back, and I was kind of trying to figure out what was going on there. But this is a movie that has like 1 hour and 45 minutes. It has a David Alan Greer in much of it. Not one laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. And actually, I know the union line you're talking about, Aisha. I know the union line. It got a laugh in mine too.
My theater was maybe a guffaw, maybe a light chuckle. I feel like laughter is an involuntary reflex, right? Like, unless you are steeling yourself to not laugh, if something is funny, you will laugh. So the fact that we sat there silently, 8 people in a movie theater at a comedy just waiting, because, you know, I came into it maybe not necessarily looking to hate. I think I was on the same page as you guys. Something had to be going on here, right? You can't make a movie called The Society of Magical Negroes and have that trailer, which basically amounted to a rom-com. And, like, I was like, oh, they're fucking with it, right? Like, there's, like, a, you know, we're going to learn a lot of different, you know, things behind the scenes about how the society works and all that. Right. To be very clear, one, don't see this movie. I would say I would recommend not seeing it from the perspective of it not being a good movie, but also, like, if you're curious about all of the things, I will summarize them for you now. Justice Smith is playing like almost a comically timid black person, like pitched up to a point that it's almost absurd. He gets recruited by David Alan Greer into the society, who explicitly, what they say in the movie is, our sole purpose is to make white people feel comfortable. This society has done more for black people than 100 marches has done. That is a line that David Alan Greer says.
Yep.
They monitor white people, like their anxiety levels. I think what they say is that it's a
white tears meter.
It's a white tears meter, but they also imply, I think it's white uncomfort that is the number one enemy of black people, right? Like, that's the summary of the movie, is that white people's uncomfortableness around black people is what makes them hostile to us. And so the whole movie, Justice Smith likes this. He likes being nice to white people. He is good at it. He says that it makes him feel good to do it. That is another line from the movie. He says he finds it calming. Then he gets assigned a white client at a, like, Facebook type tech firm that is trying to be, you know, like the big boss. He's doing like this big presentation, but he's really nervous about it. It turns out that he also has a crush on this woman, Lizzie, that Aaron has met earlier in the movie. So now there's a weird love triangle going on here. Still, Justice Smith is like, well, I can date this woman and make this white man happy, until David Alan Greer is like, you have to choose one. And he's like, well, I guess I don't like being a magical Negro anymore. I want this woman I don't care anymore. And then, like, through...
We should also note this woman is not Black.
She's not Black.
Which is its own stew of complications.
You know, I was going to get to this, but because we...
Sorry.
Oh, no. I have a whole section that I was going to call Kobe telling on himself, but I think I will avert to this now, because I've spent most of the day listening to Kobe talk about this movie. And so I'm going to read you a quote here about that I found very fascinating. And just to be clear, he is very long-winded. So this is going to go around in a couple circles, but we'll eventually land on the point. So he's asked in an interview about this specifically. Somebody says to him, kind of like, hey, you know, like, it's kind of weird that you got this movie about, you know, magical Negroes and, like, race, and, like, your main character who's Black ends up dating a white woman. And so his response to it is this. Well, the first thing is, she's not a white woman. I don't want to speak for her. And he's like, she's sitting next to him, and Annalise sitting next to him. So he's like, I don't want to speak for you, but I'm going to speak for you for just a second, which is to say that I know her experience as a human moving through the world. I know this character moving through the world is not that of a white person. And I think it's important to understand that, right? What I'm depicting here is not between a Black man and a white woman. It's a relationship between a Black man and a non-Black woman of color. And in terms of the implicit criticism there, just to be really explicit, it is that a relationship between a Black man and a white woman specifically is a negative for the Black community, because there is subtext for a lack of love for Blackness, and specifically for Black women. So the first thing I need to say, and I want to be extremely clear about this, is that it's crucially important work that we are telling stories that center Black women, that show love for Black women, and that center Black love stories. That is crucially important political work, and I'm excited to do that political work down the line. I also believe there are ways you can tell interracial stories that do incredibly positive work for the Black community, and this is one of those stories, because some of the most urgent political work we have is to not fight structural racism alone. So to me, this is an intersectional choice. What I'm portraying is not a relationship between a Black man and a white woman, but between two people of color, a Black man and a non-Black woman of color. And to me, the work of understanding that the way that structural racism impacts someone that looks like Annalie is different than the way it impacts someone who looks like Nicole or David or on and on. And the forces we're fighting against are the same. And to me, portraying the stories where we link hands and say, hey, across these racial lines, we're against some of the same obstacles, building these coalitions, telling these intersectional stories, to me, that is terrifically impactful work for the Black community and for those same Black people who don't necessarily feel seen enough in all Black love stories. So to me, even though the choice I'm making is to portray an interracial love story, to me, that is incredibly important work for the Black community. And we are a community that is in real danger if these structural racial problems aren't combated. So it's literally a life or death thing for me to do this work. End quote.
Can I respond to
Please
that?
Please do.
Please.
Okay, so here's the thing. I have nothing, absolutely nothing against interracial relationships. My partner is half white, half Black. I have dated white men. That is not the issue here. The issue is that, one, whether or not the actress refers to herself as a woman of color or not, the movie in only one line explicitly says that she is a woman of color. And it's like a sort of throwaway line where Jason, the white guy that he is his client, says, like, I didn't know she was like an ethnic or whatever.
Ethnic.
And also, yeah, he says ethnic. And that's the only hint that we get, other than like looking at her, because she does look like she could be, you know, half Asian, half white. But like, she clearly still like codes as white, or can code as white for other people. So none of that, what he is trying to describe, is even remotely a part of this story. And so you watch this movie, and yes, there's a scene where like she sides with the Justice Smith character while they're having a conversation with Jason, and Jason, that is his character's name. Where she takes his side, but like, it seems like she only takes her side because she's like, might be a good white person, not because she's like, shares an affinity with him. And so if you're trying to say all that, where is that in this actual movie? It's not there. So, you know, that whole intersection, and on top of that, whether even if she was intersectional, then you're just like saying, well, if everyone just like if everyone gets together and dates other people of other races and then has babies, then eventually racism will be solved. And that's like, that's not, they're not like fighting any truth to power or anything. They're just like in a rom-com, they want to jump each other's bones. Like, that's what it is. Come on.
Cameron, do you have any,
that's all I'll
any
say.
Thoughts on that?
Your guy should apply to be a politician. Like, that was a long-winded way of just saying, like, I didn't really do the work in this movie. I probably should. Actually, everything I'm saying, I should have probably did. You know, maybe centering blackness, centering black women, or just making direct claims in the movie, right? Just putting your 10 toes down and saying this is a woman of color in the script and in the film, right? It's a choice to put someone in the film. And I'm honestly, this speaks for the lead too, right? Justice is half black, half white. The lead female character is half white, half Asian. Both these things are, you can tell them pretty easily, right? And it's nothing to say, like, I'm personally not even coming for anyone's blackness or anybody's, you know, ethnicity or how much they identify with a certain identity. But if you're portraying something in a film, I'm not saying it's black or white, but you are making a choice by putting a person in a movie. And I think your guy tried to backtrack his way out of saying, I just wanted to put somebody in the movie that looked like me. And I do like working with people of color. However, I don't think I had a clear through line or thesis in what I was actually trying to display on screen. So I spent three paragraphs trying to backtrack on y'all. Did it work?
Cameron, Aisha, let me read you another quote from that literal same interview where he was asked about colorism in the film. One way to think about what the film is about the false promise of assimilation. So there is a suggestion in certain corners of America that if we just assimilate harder as black people or non-black people of color, if we just comply with the officer's orders, we're going to be safe. And I think that's a really dangerous lie. Part of the satire is underscoring that palatability will not save you. And to sharpen the critique of that false idea that assimilation, that palatability will save you, taking the most palatable people of color, a non-black, light-skinned woman of color, Anna Lee, and a biracial man in Justice, that even black people like this, people of color like this, will never have access to the full privileges of whiteness, despite their literal proximity to whiteness. That casting choice was extremely deliberate to highlight the falseness of that promise of assimilation. So to me, as a black filmmaker, we're always thinking about colorism. We're always thinking about the representation of us. And I know both Justice and I were both incredibly aware of the opportunity cost of presenting bodies that look like ours as opposed to darker skinned bodies. There's a politics to that, and there's a tricky politics to that. But in this case, I really do believe the choice to cast these light-skinned actors, I believe these politics are really positive for the black community, because attacking that lie about assimilation, I believe, is a tremendously important work for all black people and also non-black people of color. I think that attacking that rhetoric and ideology is really important to me. This sharpened that critique.
See, what's wrong with that right there already is you gotta have the 201 course in order to like see this movie, right? He's saying already, wait, this is great, right?
Oh, Cameron, I'd go even further than that. You got to put it in the movie.
Right.
You can't say that after the fact and then say, if you go back and watch the movie that I made, that I addressed none of that in. Never once in this relationship, like you're saying, Aisha, they're in the back of that car going after they leave the bar, after they had this weird conversation with Jason. And it's never like, Lizzie easily could have said, you know, man, like people think just because of, you know, how I look that I'm white all the time, and white people say crazy things to me. And it's always just like, you know, Aaron says, oh man, you know, like, wasn't that weird? And like, and they share these stories of like the craziest things white people have said to them, you know, thinking that they're it's acceptable because they're light skinned or they think that they're white or like whatever. Instead, they never talk about it. They never have any conversation about their racial identities.
It's just wild.
Yeah.
It's like a college course, right? You write the thesis paper. Here's my thesis. I provide examples to support said thesis. That's the problem with the movie, is that there's no examples other than, you know what it's like.
Here's an example.
It's like, tell me.
Here's an example, Cameron. Every person in the Society of Magical Negroes is dark skinned, except for
Justice. Yeah, yeah. Every one of them would not have passed the brown paper bag test. Like 100%. It's very, like. Well, on top of that, I mean, the weirdest thing. Can we just talk about the premise itself,
yes,
or the sure. the trope itself,
and the failure to address it? Go, please get into it.
Yes, because so the movie. I don't know if this is where you're going, but like where I'm going with this is like the movie opens with a definition of magical Negro, which is like a character who is just there to promote to help the white protagonist, and that's it. And of course, this is coming off of is inspired by Spike Lee kind of coining that term over 20 years ago. And he was specifically talking about like the Green Mile, you know, Bagger Vance, like a very cinematic, very specific thing. And then you have this movie, which like is supposed to be turning that idea on its head, but instead only reinforces it, because we never see the Aaron character like interacting with anyone outside of his new white client and the love interest and the magical Negroes. We know nothing about him. He is a one-dimensional character. All we know is that he's a struggling LA artist who makes weird yarn art. He offhandedly mentions his mom is white, but like, we don't know where he grew up. We don't know if he's used to being around black people, which makes that monologue you guys were talking about even more weird, because it's like, where is this coming from? What happened to you to make you like be so not just deferential to white people, but just to be like a doormat in general? Like you have no personality. I don't know why anyone would be around, want to be around you, period.
Look, let's extrapolate that out further, right? Because this movie then goes on with Lizzie, Annalise's character, and puts her in a position where she is supposed to choose between a racist, indifferent white tech bro and Justice Smith, who is basically negging her back and forth, giving her signs, taking it back, giving her signs, taking it back, and then ultimately transports her to New York and then leaves her on top of the Empire State Building. And then at the end of the movie, she's like, no, it's okay, baby. You know what I mean? Like,
it's cool.
Make this work. Where in reality, yeah, look, understandable, right? Like, woman in the workplace, your worst nightmare is a love triangle, right? You're just trying to do your job. Two men are now descending upon you, trying to claim territory.
Just trying to get the promotion, bro.
But also, like, she... Why would she choose Jason? Like, there's the third option is I don't date either of you.
Why would Jason chase her? In the movie, he literally just pops up one day because the script says he's got to and says, I like her now. I think I should court her.
Yeah.
And it is literally, it's like, so weird. It's a pop-up gag.
But also, that plot,
that's my motivation now.
Think about this plot thread, because he's sitting with David Allen Grey on top of some building while David Allen Grey is throwing papers off the top. And he says to him, literally, this is the words he uses, I like doing this. It brings me comfort to do this work. And literally, the only reason he stops doing the work is because he wants to get with Lizzie. In this situation, if she was a lesbian, if Jason was, just not interested in her, and anything like that, he's still cooning it up with the American Society of Magical Negroes. He has no reason to question anything. The only reason he doesn't want to do this is because he can't have both.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to the script, I mean, technically his monologue, what it means to be black 101 moment outburst happens when Jason tells him, like, you're just the diversity, like, face of diversity.
Like, hire.
Like that's, yeah, you're the diversity hire. But, like, at the same time, again, that is connected to his already existing animosity towards Jason, because Jason is trying to colonize his crush, as he puts it. And it's like, what, like, again, the entire time I was watching this movie, because the trailer tells you that this is what's going to happen, but the entire time I was watching this movie, I was like, there's got to be a catch. It can't just be this. It can't just... Nope. It was just that. It's just...
can I ask you guys?
Just someone.
Am I crazy? Yeah. Or are the American Society of Magical Negroes, are they not the villains of this movie? Am I?
Well, they're supposed to be, but again, it doesn't end that way.
No.
Right. Like, we need them to keep persisting, you know, invisibly in the world. Otherwise, possible catastrophe, right? Implosion of race politics.
David Alan Greer says he's going to keep doing the work, and we're supposed to like him.
What's the work? Every time we see his character, he's dressing up like a different type of boat captain. Also, just another gag that just like fell like a giant turd. It's supposed to be that everybody at the company, their position title is not like program manager or CEO or something like that.
Based.
They're all maritime based, so like he's a boatswain, and it's just like,
yeah,
who was that joke for? Who was it for?
Who's the?
It's.
Oh, go ahead, Aisha.
No, I mean it just also speaks to how stuck in time this movie is, because like even the sort of clever-ish, I guess, like gag where Aisha Hines' character is instructing, like offering instruction videos of the classic magical Negro trope. Like she goes through all of these like clearly plucked from Bagger Vance, Green Mile, like set in the 1930s examples, and then she says like, of course we'll use more contemporary versions, but like then we never see what a magical Negro might look like in the present day. So it's like, no, this doesn't make any sense. Like one of the magical Negroes who, like, I don't think he has any lines, but he shows up a couple of times and he's like on a farm and like in overalls and looks like.
Can I even ask? This movie never even proffers an idea. Why are they here? Who are all these? Justice Smith is brought in specifically by David Alan Greer to join a already in progress class. Who are all these other black people? How did they hear about it? Why are they here? What do they want?
One scene of like them at the cafeteria being like, oh man, they called me up in like 1978. I've been cooning since then. Like, you know,
they never talk about it.
What are we doing here? Like,
this movie fails the Blackdale test because he never talks to another black person about anything except for white people.
It's so weird because all the politics. No, you're right. You're right. All the politics that the movie tries to reinforce, it doesn't take any of those opportunities. And if anything, it uses its subversion to reinforce, right?
Yes.
This movie, the idea, like in the title alone, right? Magical Negroes. We're talking about the trope. We're addressing the trope. But every time we walk right up to, I mean, literally in the scene, there's another scene where they're wearing MetaQuest goggles and kind of talking through his not really wanting to apologize for, you know, being black, not apologizing for the work he does, and talking to Jason about the fact that he doesn't deserve the promotion that he's getting. He's going to do the big presentation at the end of the movie, but he got it because he's a man and the CEO's a man, so on and so forth. But during that conversation, and the gag is that he's walking up to the edge blindly with the MetaQuest on, right? And he's about to fall down the stairs. Mm-hmm. But in that conversation, he literally walks right up to the edge of the conversation saying, like, asking Jason, well, you know, you got the job, but what if the other person was actually more talented than you? Does that, like, occur to you? And literally at that moment, he's about to fall over. And Jason tells him, hey, well, don't fall there. Whoa. Let's just go back to this gag and finish the scene. Like every opportunity to subvert the trope is just pulled back right before we get there.
Yeah, it's a perfect metaphor. Well,
I was gonna ask, do we even, right? Like the magical Negro trope and magical Negroes in film. Like you said, Aisha, like they have no family, they have no backstory, they just appear and disappear at the perfect time to, you know, influence this white person's life. In this movie, I think what I'm hearing, because there's a number of lines that stuck out to me, but there is a line when Nicole Byer kicks somebody out for the first time and she says, and now you will suffer the worst punishment that anybody could ever imagine. you will have to live life as a regular black person in America. And I was like, did you mm-hmm. want me to see this movie? The regular black person who made money?
Right. Who was apparently suffering the worst fate known to the magical Negroes.
Well, again, all of this would be interesting and perhaps even funny. I mean, like the way it's executed, it's not. But like just the idea of that, and the idea of these people, these respectability politics people existing, would be great if it ended with some sort of like acknowledgement that they, like you said, Jordan, are the villains. Like they are the ones who like we should not be rooting for. And also like just the logic of the way this world works, because like at the end of the movie, Aaron has upset the balance and now the magical Negroes are going to be a little less Negro, I guess. They're going to be a little less like deferential, but they're still going to keep doing their job. And they're like, we'll be okay. And I'm like, but I thought the whole point was that like if anyone upsets the balance, then everything goes awry. So like what are we saying here? That even the logic of this world that he has built doesn't like commit.
No,
it's just in like the movie, everything falls apart.
I again, after I watched it, I had to go and double check things because there's multiple references they make to real life actual black people and reference them as
Crispus Attucks,
a man who escaped slavery and then died fighting white people.
What? Yeah.
Huh? The woman who's on the box of Aunt Jemima? You mean the woman who General Mills ripped off and didn't pay her any compensation, so she died poor in an unburied... That woman?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah.
What are you saying? I'm not connecting the dots. I'm not understanding. The slaves at Monticello started this organization to get lesser punishments.
But the crazy, like, how did they even start the organization? Or were they magical to begin with? Again, like, the movie doesn't care about its own, like, magic. All the magic is, like, just base magic. It's like they're literally doing like poof magic tricks in front of you on the screen. Like the flame is here now. It was over there. Oh.
Well, I thought it was maybe like Hogwarts. Like you have to learn your magic powers because obviously Aaron doesn't have them.
Let's break it down though.
Like this is the thing. Whole movie.
This is the thing when people saw the trailer, they said, "Oh shit, yeah, it's gonna be like they're gonna have magic and do all kinds of they." I think on one hand I can count. They teleport one time. He transfers that white woman's bag from Aaron's hand back to her hand. Aaron makes a mm-hmm. laptop appear. He teleports her one more time to the
Empire State Building.
And I think maybe one more thing. That's five things, literally, in the whole movie.
In 2 hours.
And most of them are literally just the camera pans and then pans back. And something is now where it wasn't before.
Right.
So it's not even like effects.
Right. And it's like, if you have that magic, then why can't you just cure racism? It's like, how powerful are you? Like, what are we doing here?
I mean, that would even be funny if we was like bootleg magical Negroes.
I don't want to give this movie any credit because I think, again, having now listened to Kobe talk a lot, there's a lot of do the work for me in reverse happening here. Ooh. So like even in that final scene that we keep harkening back to as big monologue, an intelligent film may be inferring that these white people are talking over him in order to silence him now that he's thinking these things and making these statements and finding himself. And yet in the movie those things are what the white people are saying are supposed to be funny. Like it's supposed to be they're doing bits over his speech.
All the cutaways and big bits. Yeah.
So it's not even them like trying to like, oh, no, don't say that. It's like they're doing like independent bits on top of his speech. And then he's at once saying that he does not need white approval while yet saying these things to white people, hoping that they see him and approve of what he's saying. So there's a dissonance that's not even like... coming into focus. And I think it's similar when you think about, like, oh, the magical Negro, right? Like, they're ostensibly coons, right? So, like, the proximity to whiteness is what gives you your power, right? Like, the more that you're in these spaces with these white people, you're able to access things that other black people aren't able to access, and you're doing things that other black people aren't able to do, so you feel special. However, at any moment, once they decide that you're not special anymore, power's gone, right? Like, you're disconnected, you don't have that. That's not what the movie's right. doing. The movie's saying that if you get any ideas about talking back to these white people, we are going to kick you out. We are going to excommunicate you back to the real world.
Wouldn't that be so great?
And erase your memory.
Wouldn't that be so great? Wouldn't that be so great if, like, every time Candace Owens was out here on Twitter talking just absolute nonsense, everybody was like, oh shit, oh my, you know, my things acted up. We all got to go get it checked. We all got to figure this one out so we can be better. Mm-hmm. But instead, nothing happens.
I just want to go around real quick and just individually pitch better movies. Because when you think about look, the Key and Peele sketch that everybody was referencing and was hoping that that was going to be the two Key and Peele sketches, the one that's like Black Hogwarts and the other one with the Black Magical Negro fight. When you look at the Astronomy Club Netflix sketch of the rehabbing the Black Magical Negro characters, like, there's different ways that you could approach this. I mean, even thinking about it, like, again, they literally do the trope in the movie. Like, the characters are doing it and not questioning it. So even thinking about it from, like, a Get Out standpoint, where, like, in Hollywood, you know, like, we talk about it all the time. These are the roles, right? Like, Michael Clark Duncan wasn't like, hey, I really want to play, you know, this civil black character. He's like, Steven Spielberg is making a movie and I can be in it and maybe win an award. And
to be clear, though, these were the roles. They're not really the roles anymore.
Right.
Like, there aren't that many. Like, this is not as much of an issue as it was 20 years ago, which is another issue I have with this.
Right.
Even 10 years ago, like, this isn't...
Slave was like 10 years ago.
And that's not a magical Negro character. That's a very different kind of movie. Yeah, like,
but even just thinking about, like, what you just said, though, like, so now these roles are drying up and, like, this is all these people have been doing their whole career. And now they're like, it's almost like a Get Out situation where they're, like, stuck in the magical Negro. Like, it's their life now and they can't turn it off. You know what I mean? And so, like, there's all these different ways that you could approach it. Like, what are, in your mind, when you were watching this movie and thinking, like, here's the movie I wish I was watching. What, did you have any ideas of, like, how we could have done this better?
Oh, God, I had so many ideas. I was just like, you should have put me in the room. I should have been someone vetting this script. I think it went through this, like, a Sundance program. So I was like, oh, God, I wish I had been in the room when they were pitching this. Because my biggest thing is that, like, I would have kept some of the stuff about, you know, basically all the respectability politics stuff, because I do think it's interesting to point that out, that mindset does exist. But then, like... So when Spike Lee was initially talking about it, he said something along the lines of, like, the magical Negro character. It's like, you have all these powers and you're not going to use it to save black people, to help black people. And that would be what I would hope, is that, like, either the Aaron character decides, well, I have these powers, but what if I, like, sneakily start actually helping black people instead of trying to help this white person? Or if there's, like, an entire other society of actual black radical magical black people who were, like, trying to counter these guys, and they clash, and there's, like, a big battle at the end, and then, like, Aaron has to decide which side he wants to be on. Like, the fact that this movie just pretends as if Harriet Tubman didn't exist, you know, the Black Panthers never came along, like, they claim all the responsibility for black people living longer.
I would go a step further. It's not even that they deny those people, it's that they're wrong. You know what I mean? Like, it's they are the problem. They need to shut up.
Yes.
Yeah, I was about to say, if they're speaking up, then the magical Negroes don't got no work.
You know what I mean? That's what's so crazy about this movie. It's just like, it's delivering all of these respectability ideas. And then the most Aaron has to say about it is, like, maybe you guys should update the name, because Negro's a little outdated. That's all the notes he has.
Yeah. And then he's like, sorry, this isn't for me. I want to bone this ethnically ambiguous woman. Yeah. Okay.
I've got bigger fish to fry.
Cameron, what are you thinking?
I guess I would keep stuff too, because I think the premise is what made anyone go see this movie, right? So I think, sure, title, keep the basic premise. I'm, again, not interested in, like, being colorist or anything like that, but if you're going to make a movie called Magical Negroes, you need to have a dark-skinned protagonist if you're bringing us into the world. You're bringing us into a world that mostly dark-skinned people are reacting to, right? Or react to in their daily lives. So you gotta show us the work. And I think it kind of starts there. And I don't think it needs this romantic comedy plot. Get rid of that. And maybe bring in all the black tropes, right? Bring in the magical Negroes, bring in a white savior to see if he thinks he can save the magical Negroes. Bring in a militant black person from revolutionary movies, from blaxploitation. You know, I think my biggest thing with the movie is that it almost doesn't even acknowledge that while it's a trope, while it's a cinematic trope, it doesn't acknowledge that it's part of like a cinematic lineage, right? Other than those two scenes, and only to miss the point after doing it, right?
Well, the point is that there's a three-step dick joke that they have to tell start to finish. So that's why that's there.
Wait, is that the one with the guy grabbing the crotch? Okay.
Yeah.
That was another thing I was like, what?
Is that even funny? It was like, you could hear the question mark popping up over people's heads in my audience. They're like, huh? But why does he have to grab his crotch in order to make him feel better?
Well, because it's not even a joke. They're literally just doing the scenes from the movies. Like, they're just like, do...
But like, what movie?
Green Mile, what, in I what guess. Movie?
Well, because the joke...
Is that what happened?
Well,
I've never seen Green Mile, to be honest.
Oh, Green Mile is actually like...
Wait, is it...
It's really
he does grab Tom Hanks' crotch at a point. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that completely went over my head.
Yeah. But also in Green Mile, like, the way he, like, uses the magic is kind of egregious, because it'll be like, oh, man, my life is so hard. I got all these things going on in me. And he'll literally... What he does in the Green Mile is he takes their pain... And, like, through putting his hand on them, like, takes the actual pain out of their body. Like, it's gold. It's golden around their bodies and stuff. And then he spits it out like moths into the air.
Yeah, I've seen that part. I just
didn't know. You know.
Crotch
grab.
You know, okay, yeah.
Stupid that is. and what they were trying to do right there and, like, completely, again, missing it. It's just, like, I'm cool with a movie that doesn't have a whole lot of plot, honestly, just wants to show me a bunch of jokes. Like, I'm cool with Chappelle's Show, the movie, right? One of my favorite movies is Pootie Tang. It doesn't make sense. I understand. I knew that going in. But unfortunately, none of these jokes meet in the middle. None of them acknowledge, like, actual racial trauma, actual, like, real-life Black experiences. They really just kind of, like, reflect and flex the trope that they're actually talking about without actually investigating. And I think it would be just fine as like just a jokes per minute kind of situation where we're just laughing at goofy trope jokes that Black people understand. But I feel like this movie is too in service of like white people and its own lame plot to even try to make you laugh about the thing that is fucked up about that part of cinema.
This movie feels very much akin to season 3 of Atlanta, where it's just like...
Say more.
Now, I thought you were going to be talking to me, but I think you're just talking to white people. I think I'm just looking over my shoulder, waiting for the part where you're looking. There is no part in this movie where Justice Smith, like you were saying, Cameron, comes back in after a hard day working for those white people and sits down at the Magical Negro Cafeteria. And, like, Black people are just dishing, just shooting the shit, talking shit about
that
the white
scene people. Alone, can you believe would kill.
What, you know, they said, I can't, you know, like, just down the line over and over again. There is zero community in this movie. he accepts without any receipts the fact that this society is helping black. He never goes up to another black person and says, "Hey, brother, can I just ask you a question? Is your life better today?"
What about your family that's like non-magical Negroes? Are you helping them? Is this helping them?
I mean, he just on face value just says, "I guess this work is doing great things for black people all over the country," and never once is like, maybe in Aisha's movie, you know, like that's the halfway point, is that he realizes, oh, I'm on the wrong side. I should be over there with them, but I'm here. How do I correct this situation? Because it's just crazy to watch him. I mean, that was the thing. Season 3 of Atlanta was just like, there's a lot of you talking directly to white people, like really just saying to them, "Hey, racism, crazy, right? What do you guys think about that? Is that,
what do y'all think,
something that's affecting y'all too?" Mm-hmm. Maybe should we have a conversation? This is a safe place, so you can tell me how you feel about. At the end of the movie, did you guys catch this? Justice Smith does that whole speech, right, to Jason. All the other white people flailing around doing all kinds of crazy stuff. Jason the whole time, like, protesting, "Hey, I'm not racist. Why would you call me racist? I don't know." And then at the end of the speech, Jason's like, "Oh man, I'm sorry. I get you now," or something along those. So you have to redeem Jason. You have to do that,
right?
Well, then also his response is like, "It's okay, man," or something. And I'm just like, no. if this really bothered you, why? Come on, dude. You're still like dead. Like, just, he's so, nothing about his character is, it doesn't even need to be likable, but I need him to like have a backbone. My God.
Like, well, he wasn't even like a full set of like racist tropes. He would occasionally say a racist thing. He would occasionally do a chauvinist thing, right? He just accepts the job because, sure, I guess I did the hardest work on the team and I deserve the promotion. I just deserve to talk to the CEO or whatever. He's just like blindly going through what the movie says for him to do, take the promotion. "I like the girl." Literally in the halfway point of the movie, he says, "I like her now. I like that kid.
Tells him a whole sad story about how he had to not fall in love because his duty to the society over. But again, it's told in a way, that story and the story he tells about a guy spitting on his dad are both told in a way to garner sympathy for him. Yeah. The character, and also, like, the quote is too long because, again, you heard the other two quotes that I gave you from Kobe, but he basically insinuates that he overlearned lessons from his childhood that, you know, his parents would tell him about how to, you know, interact with the police and all of these things, and so he feels like he interpreted that strongly and is very deferential to white people and, like, feels a kind of way, and like, now is respectability politics bad, you know, like, we've learned better, except your movie is like respectability politics the movie.
It's like this movie wants to critique, I think it wants to critique respectability politics, but it still wants to be respectable to respectability politics politicians. So it's like, you can't have it both ways. You've either got to reject it's to me, like, I don't know, it's like, this is probably a bad metaphor, but like, when you think about people who are like, "Well, yeah, my family member doesn't accept me because I'm gay or whatever, but like, I still love them," or "I'm still trying," and I'm like, you don't have to do that. Like, we don't have to make these people feel more comfortable.
No.
In fact, we should, the opposite. Bare minimum, cut them out or, like, don't interact with them as much.
Yes.
But, yeah, this he doesn't want to do that. Clearly from this movie, it's like, we want everyone to feel somewhat good.
Your boy
hands across America early. He was really trying to get everybody to just join in song and racism be over.
I'd like to buy the world a Coke.
I guess I want to close on this because I know you got to get out of here, Aisha. But like, I do. There's a whole motif. There's a real dumb Venn diagram that they draw in the movie. That's like, on this side, you know, like white, like the things that make white people feel good, you know what I mean? And like being able to be approachable and palatable to white people. And then like what they think about black people or like presenting authentic blackness. And then there's the things that you keep for yourself, I guess, is how they end that. Without ever acknowledging, right? Like, because they talk about it in a way that's like, and this is how we do the work and what keeps people safe, right? Without ever acknowledging that Emmett Till was just minding his business with his friends and a white woman decided, I don't like the way that he's looking at me. If he was ever even looking at me, somebody should kill him. And they did. Without ever acknowledging that James Blake, the tennis player, was standing outside of a hotel in New York in a suit and got tackled by the police because they said he fit the description. Without acknowledging all the black people who just lived their life and white people decided it's not even about my uncomfortability around them. I just don't like them. You know what I mean? I'm actually very comfortable. What makes me uncomfortable is the idea of them having autonomy.
Yeah. And that's the crux of this movie, right? Is that like these characters, these magical Negroes believe that them kind of tending to white people's midlife crises or whatever is going to somewhere down the line keep them from hurting another black person. But like, that's not how the world works. Like, you could have your problem solved and then like you could just be in a bad mood and then, you know, shoot a black person or shoot someone who doesn't look like you. And the fact that the movie doesn't ever want to challenge that notion, it's not that it presents that, it's the fact that it doesn't challenge it.
No.
Yeah.
And I don't need every movie to have like a moral to the story, but like this movie kind of needs to have a moral to the story because it's positing itself as a satire that is supposed to be have teeth,
yeah.
That is supposed to be like attacking. And it doesn't.
No. Even a quick scene of Aaron at that same coffee shop he was at before and just a black person being like harassed by somebody and him trying to intervene and like it's not working because it's not about their having tears or being upset. They're just racist. And this is happening. And you can't magical Negro your way out of the situation. Like this is what's happening right now in front of your face. Like even that would be like, hey, wait a minute. Like, that usually works. It's not working now. What's not? Mm-hmm. What's different about this situation? Oh, no. Right? Just thinking about it. Anyways, Aisha, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
For people who, don't know all the things that you have going on, please tell people about your wonderful book, Wannabe. Please tell people where they can find your work on NPR, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, you can find my work and that of my colleagues' work at NPR on Pop Culture Happy Hour. We talk about a lot of film, TV, books, music. We won't be talking about this because we were like, is it worth it? But I did write a full review of it on NPR, so you can find it there. And also definitely check out my book, Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. It's a collection of pop culture-related essays. I actually tackle a lot of the things we've talked about in this conversation in a couple of chapters. So you can find that wherever you get your books, whether it's the library, Amazon, the audiobook. I read it myself.
Nice.
It's fun.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.